This week we will be studying Ruth chapter 1. Ruth is the 8th book of the Bible, and along with Esther, it is one of only two that is named after a woman. The book tells the story of a woman of Moab named Ruth and how she came to be married to a man named Boaz of Judah. The story is primarily significant because, in the end, spoiler alert, Ruth would become the great-grandmother of David, who would become king of Israel. If you have been listening along chronologically, you know that most recently we have been studying the book of Judges. Having recently finished that book, this is the perfect time to start studying Ruth, because Ruth takes place in the same time frame. In today's passage, we will be introduced to the main characters in Ruth's narrative, and the problem, that being that Ruth was a widow in need of a husband. The remainder of the book thereafter will present the solution for that problem. In the course of our study of the passage, we will have the occasion to consider such diverse topics as immigration law, marriage law, and our inability to see the whole plan of God. Your passage is Ruth chapter 1. If you have not yet read it, I recommend that you pause and do so now. At the beginning of any new book, I like to start off with a brief recap of what happened so far in the Bible. In Genesis, God created everything, including humans, with whom he had an ideal relationship, but the humans sinned against God and the relationship was broken. The Bible tells the story of how that relationship is restored. God chose a people, the descendants of Israel, to be the people with whom he would have a special relationship and through whom the whole world would ultimately be blessed with full restoration. But the people of Israel fell into slavery in Egypt. In the book of Exodus, God raised up Moses to deliver Israel with mighty wonders. The people escaped to the wilderness, where God gave them his laws to facilitate their relationship to him and each other. Leviticus extends the topic of the laws. In Numbers, the Israelites rebelled against God and spent a generation wandering the wilderness as a penalty, but eventually in Deuteronomy, they conquered their first piece of land east of the Jordan River. Moses died there. Joshua, in his book, took up the helm and led the people of Israel across the Jordan River into the land that God had promised to give them. He led a military campaign to establish Israel in the land. After his death, Israel went through a tumultuous period in which they were repeatedly enslaved by the surrounding nations and then fought to free themselves. During their periods of freedom, they were ruled over by the judges, and the book about them is called Judges as well. And that's where the book of Ruth comes in, because the first verse of today's passage says explicitly that this book took place during the reign of the judges. How all of this would culminate in the salvation of the world and restoration of God's people to himself was not yet made clear, but what I will tell you is that the period of the judges was coming to an end. The Israelites were tired of the constant state of war, and they wanted a king to protect them from foreign aggressors and to give them stability. In time, they would have a king named David, and the events of Ruth are significant because they tell the story of David's great-grandmother Ruth. Now, exactly when the events of the book of Ruth occurred during the period of the judges is unclear. Ruth was the great-grandmother of King David, so I would guess this takes place at least 80 years before his reign. However, biblical genealogies often skip generations, so Ruth's life could have occurred anywhere from the rule of Othniel, the first judge, to the rule of Samson, the last judge in the book of Judges. My general presumption is that the famine of Ruth occurred during the 40 years when Israel was oppressed by Philistia, described in Judges 13, and that Ruth returned to Judah when Samson was judge. But that's speculative. The story begins in Bethlehem. Bethlehem was a city in Judah. Note that Ephrath is an alternative name for Bethlehem, care of Genesis 35:19. So when today's passage mentions that our main characters were Ephrathites, it's just another way of saying that they came from Bethlehem. Judah was one of Israel's 12, or 13, depending on how you count them, tribes, and Judah had inherited a large portion of land east of the Jordan River and in the south. The name Bethlehem means house of bread, and in this case that is ironic, because there was a famine in the land. The house of bread had not enough bread. And thus, Elimelech, whose name means God is king, took a wife Naomi, whose name means pleasant, and along with their two sons they went seeking better fortunes in the land of Moab. Moab was a nation dwelling to the east and south of Israel. Their land was situated on the east bank of the Dead Sea, south of the Arnon River. And of note, if you'd like to see a map showing various locations in the Book of Ruth, we have an interactive map of Israel in our library. A link to that map will appear on the page hosting this message when you correctly answer your quiz question for this message. The quiz question will appear when you click the question mark on the top left of the page. The Moabites were distant relatives of the Israelites. We first mentioned Moab back on August 14th of 2016 in a sermon titled Lot and His Daughters, which covered the birth of their forebearer in Genesis 19:30-38. Israel was descended from Abraham, while Moab was descended from Abraham's nephew Lot. In part because of this relationship, Israel had left Moab in their territory which God had allotted them, but they were not always friendly. In fact, Moab was often an enemy in war. It might seem strange to us that Elimelech would be willing to bring his family to live among a people who were often enemies of his own, but I suppose that hunger will push people to do such things. I want to note here that this family from Judea was free to cross the border into Moab. The laws of God do not prohibit people from traveling from one place to another, but we'll get more into that when we get to application of the passage. Elimelech had two sons by Naomi. They were named Mahlon and Chilion. They went with their parents to Moab. Each of them took a wife, Ruth and Orpah, respectively, and they died, leaving no heir. The name of Mahlon means sick, while the name of Chilion means wasting away. This might be an indicator that they were born in bad health, which in turn might be an indicator that the famine had been going on for some time before the family finally left Judah. It was 10 years after they left Judah that Naomi would return, and both brothers had married and died in the meantime. If they married at an age like, say, 16, they would have to have been older than 6 when they left Judah. If the famine had made them sick at birth, then the famine must have gone on for more than 6 years before they left town. But that's all speculative. Maybe they were just sickly children because of some other cause. Or maybe these names simply displayed a negative attitude held by either one or the other or both of the parents. Naomi, who by the end of the story calls herself bitter, might have just been the type to see the glass as half empty. And since we're on a kick of giving the meaning of everyone's name, Ruth means friendship and Orpah means gazelle. Both of those seem to be irrelevant to the story. In verse 6, we read that the famine ended and that Naomi decided to return home to Judah. This naturally created some conflict. Naomi was from Judah, but Ruth and Orpah were not. Reading from a modern perspective, we might think that there is no real conflict in that, because the tie between mother-in-law and daughter-in-law is not very strong in our culture. Once Naomi's sons died, we would generally consider that the tie between the family was broken. This, however, was not the Hebrew way of doing things. We have discussed before that marriage, as contemplated in the Bible, is essentially a property exchange. A daughter is, to put it roughly, owned by her father, and a suitor would come and ask his permission to have her. He would pay a bride price, and she would become his. The bride didn't just take the husband's name. She left the one family and joined the other. The bride was so deeply bonded to the family that, if she had not borne a son, when her husband died, she was expected under the custom of levirate marriage to go to his brother, who would then father a son with her so that the son could inherit the name of the family. In this case, all of the brothers were dead, and so Ruth would be passed on to the next of kin, whomever that might be. For more on that, you could listen to our message, Levirate Marriage, published February 12, 2017, and covering Deuteronomy 25:5-10. So Ruth and Orpah both had a duty to stay with Naomi until they could be delivered to this next of kin, and that's where the conflict came in. To stay with Naomi and fulfill this duty, they would have had to give up everything and everyone they had ever known. Seeing that this was the case, Naomi told her daughters-in-law to go back to their birth families from which they came in hopes that they could meet new husbands there. Obviously, finding a husband, whether in Naomi's family or otherwise, would have been very important for them. A husband could be a protector and provider in an uncertain and dangerous world. And he could give them children who would provide for them in their old age. And he could give them all of the other benefits that come from family and society and so forth. At first, both women refused to leave Naomi, evidently sorrowful at the thought of losing her, but also insisting that they would do their duty to their deceased husbands. Naomi insisted, though. She said that they had dealt kindly with both her and the dead, but she argued that there would be no likelihood that they could either fulfill their duty to their husbands or have a fulfilling life with her. She had no husband. She had no sons left. Even if she, an old woman, had been able to bring another son into the world, it would have taken him so long to grow up that he could not have been expected to be a husband to either of these women. Naomi had resigned herself to a difficult fate, that she should have much difficulty in sustaining herself and that she should die alone, taking the name of her husband's family with her. It was a bitter turn of fate for her. We note that she accurately attributed this hardship to Jehovah, but she wrongly judged his motivations. She said that Jehovah had turned against her. In fact, the rest of the book will show that circumstances were not as bleak as Naomi thought, and that the circumstances ultimately would be for God's glory. He hadn't turned his back on her. He was acting with a purpose. They all wept at the tragedy of the situation, and Orpah chose to go back to Moab. With much grief, she abandoned her duty, kissed Naomi goodbye, and turned and went home. There, we guess, she might have had higher expectations for a prosperous future, and maybe it went well for her in the short term. But what became of her is a mystery lost to time. Ruth, on the other hand, despite persistent urging and the expectation of much hardship, refused to flinch. She had made up her mind that she would be faithful to Naomi and to her duty. In the end, this strategy brought her much glory as the mother of a great king of the people of God. Verses 16 and 17 are probably the two best-known verses of the book of Ruth, primarily because they have been commonly read at weddings. In them, Ruth declared her final intentions on the matter. She told Naomi to stop urging her to go back to Moab. Why? Because wherever Naomi would go, Ruth would go. She would join Naomi's people, and she would serve Naomi's God. She insisted that she would die in the same place that Naomi would die, and she swore this with a standard self-maledictory oath, that Jehovah would do so to her, that is, that he would kill her and bury her, and more also if she broke this commitment. As we have seen in the past, starting with Abraham, such self-maledictory oaths in Jehovah's name were the surest way to seal a covenant. The terms of Ruth's commitment was that she would not leave till death. And having heard this, Naomi gave up her argument. The two returned to Bethlehem, and on arriving, they found that they were the talk of the town. Towns were smaller then, and people were closer knit. There were no newspapers, but news spread fast. I suppose that when Naomi had left in the famine, that there was an occasion for much sorrow. Probably her friends and relatives and neighbors thought that she would never be back. But here she was, as if back from the dead. For them, this was cause for celebration. But Naomi, once pleasant, told her friends that they ought not to call her that anymore. She was no longer pleasant in her estimation, but bitter because of the bitter circumstances which God had dealt her. And so she asked that she be called Mara, which means bitter. And thus the stage is set. We have a conflict that needs to be resolved. Naomi was bitter because of the hard circumstances. Ruth needed a husband to do her duty to the dead, and there is hope on the horizon. The barley harvest was set to begin, and we will see what opportunities it brought them when we continue our study next week. Having contemplated the passage, we move on to practical applications. First, Naomi was wrong when she said that Jehovah was against her, and it is a shame that she allowed that belief to make her bitter. God was not against Naomi. Naomi was one of God's people, and God is not against his people. Much to the contrary, as we have discussed many times before, God ultimately works everything out for the best interest of his people. The difficulty for Naomi was not that God was against her, but that God was working on something bigger than her. For us, our lives are everything. They are all we ever experience. We have limited knowledge, but God, on the other hand, has all knowledge. He comprehends all experience. God understands that one life is less than a billionth part of the whole picture. God's master plan has been to glorify himself by sending his son Jesus to die for the sins of humanity, and that plan was at work in Naomi's time over 1,000 years before Jesus was born. For the full glorification of Jesus to be achieved, God had planned for him to be heir to the throne of his chosen people of Israel, and he would be heir to the throne through King David. And for that to happen, God had planned that David should be born, and thus David was descended from Ruth, And David would not have descended from Ruth as the person that he was if Naomi had not suffered a famine that sent her to Moab where Ruth was, and if Naomi had not suffered a sickly child who had taken a wife only to die young, and if Naomi's husband had not died such that Naomi would struggle in Moab and return back to Judah. Naomi's life was no doubt miserable, but removing any of her miserable circumstances would have cut off the lineage of Jesus or otherwise diminished his glory. And the infinite glory of God, which has brought about the salvation of all his people, is simply more important than the temporal suffering of one person. If Naomi had known this, she might have remained more pleasant. She might have said, "I have suffered much, but they are sacrifices that I am glad to make for the sake of bringing glory to God." Unfortunately, Naomi didn't know this. She didn't realize that God was working for his glory, or for the general welfare of humanity, or for her own final best interest. She was looking at the small picture. Because she had this limited self-focus, her situation made her bitter. She didn't take joy in God's work and her ultimate hope. She despaired. My hope for you, then, is that in difficult circumstances you will not despair and that you will not allow bad circumstances to make you bitter. My hope is that you will have the wisdom not to blame God for your troubles. Instead, I hope that you will glorify God even when your times are hard. I hope that you will see that God acts for the best interest, and that you will willingly make a sacrifice of yourself for the greater good of his plan, knowing that in the end, those who do will receive glory. And in your struggles, I hope that you, like Ruth, will cling to your duty despite your difficulty. God's command was clear. Ruth belonged to the family of her husband, and she was to go to his next of kin. This is not an inconsequential matter. We have mentioned many times before that marriage exists to demonstrate the nature of God to the world. Ephesians chapter 5 gives clear instruction on this. That chapter makes clear that husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. The love and provision and self-sacrifice of a husband for his wife demonstrates to the world the love that Jesus has for his people. Likewise, wives are to submit to and respect their husbands. This demonstrates the respect that the church has for God. The point, then, is that marital devotion and marriage itself exists to show a picture of the relationship of God to the world. Ruth owed a duty to her husband that she should propagate his name in the earth, just as mankind has a duty to magnify the name of God to the world. The performance of this duty mattered, and a failure to do it would present to the world a distorted picture of what it means to glorify God. And not only this, but a failure to make every possible effort to fulfill this command would be a disobedience to and disrespect of God directly. But on the day when Naomi returned from Moab, the likelihood of fulfilling the marital duty and having a prosperous life seemed low. As Naomi framed the problem, whoever went to Judah with her to honor God and his commands would be facing a life of solitude and poverty. Both Orpah and Ruth were given the option at the fork in the road: serve the one true God on the path of sacrifice, or go home and seek your own pleasure. Orpah took the broad way of self-service and disappeared from history, while Ruth took the narrow path of self-sacrifice and became a grandmother of an eternal dynasty of kings, finding its final fulfillment in Jesus Christ himself. In the moment, in the small picture, the path of disobedience and self-service seemed like the better path, but it led to ignominy. In the broader reality, the path of obedience and sacrifice led to eternal glory. The same options hang before us in our daily lives. I hope you will choose correctly. And finally, I want to make a quick mention of the biblical stance on immigration laws. I'm not going to dig too deeply into this because I've already published a full message on the topic. That was titled Foreigners, Strangers, Sojourners, Immigrants, Aliens, and was published May 6th of 2018. So, if you want a very dense breakdown of the topic, you could listen to that. But the gist of it is this. People have a natural right to be at liberty to go to whatever land they want. Scripture does not justify creating an arbitrary border and banning everyone from crossing it. The law did, however, establish certain rights for members of the covenant people once they were in those borders. So a person would be free to cross into Israel's territory for the sake of visiting and working and so forth, but that person did not automatically receive what in modern parlance would be called a citizenship, even if he was born in Israel's territory or brought there as a child. A person who crossed the border couldn't own land or receive financial assistance, etc. Today, it is often perceived as a problem under the U.S. that people, particularly Central Americans, crossing the U.S. border are essentially destroying American culture for the native-born U.S. citizens. As a result, violent or coercive measures are often used to keep people from crossing the borders, and that is an example of a problem which presents itself across the globe. I do not believe it is right or effective to use walls to stop people from peacefully crossing a border for the purpose of working. Such people are just like Naomi and Ruth were. They were looking for a better life, and they had a natural human right to be at liberty to go where they pleased to pursue that. A much better solution to solving the immigration problem is to turn off the magnet that draws people over a border, to disincentivize immigration. The U.S. problem is largely built on birthright citizenship, which gives a person citizenship if only his mother can illegally cross the border 1 minute before giving birth. That incentivizes pregnant women to go to the U.S. to have children. And citizenship aside, migrants have access to health care and public education and other financial assistance aimed at their welfare. Well, the scriptures wouldn't allow that for people crossing into Israel, and I'm sure that Moab wouldn't have allowed it for people crossing in there either. Under the law of Moses, migrants, even migrants who joined the covenant, could never own land, and neither could their descendants, unless they married into landowning families. So the ability to own land is another incentive that would bring people across a border. So to summarize, the scriptural position is not to close the borders. The scriptural position, and the one that maintains the highest degree of human liberty and respects the rights of people on both sides of the border, would be to allow migrant workers and other peaceful travelers to freely cross borders without giving incentives to those people to cross. A pathway to what we would call citizenship would be available to those who would accept the ideology of the people and join them and adopt their culture. In the scriptures, that included accepting the God of Israel and his covenant, but those who joined the covenant were still unable to own land, so they couldn't just come in and take advantage. To conclude then, Ruth chapter 1 presents a conflict which will be resolved through the rest of the book. The conflict is this. Ruth had been widowed, and she owed a duty to her husband to bear him a son to carry on his name. Ruth chose to stand by that duty despite the potential for hardship. In considering this conflict, we have contemplated other important subjects: the importance and meaning of marriage, the path to glory that leads through sacrifice, the mysterious way that God works for the ultimate good in the picture larger than our own comprehension, and even in immigration laws. And for how the dramatic tension of Ruth will be resolved, we will plan to consider that in coming weeks.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.